Hey, everybody. Welcome back to another episode of the Negotiation Podcast. I am your host, Todd Embley. And on today's show, we are happy to welcome back Justin Downs, president of Axis Leisure Management, one of the foremost experts on skiing and winter sports development in Asia. With nearly two decades of experience shaping China's ski and snowboard industry, including playing a role in the infrastructure behind the Beijing 2022 Winter Olympics, Justin brings a rare on-the-ground perspective. More recently, his work in Japan's ski market gives him a comparative lens on how Asia's two most important winter sports economies are evolving. With the Milan 2026 Winter Olympics on the horizon, this conversation dives into participation trends, market growth, and where the biggest opportunities lie for brands, operators, and investors across China and Japan. Enjoy.
The Chinese skier is quite different. They're not going to ski all day, every day. They're not going to be on the lift at 8:30 and still skiing at 4. You know, they'll ski for a couple of hours. They'll want to go to hot springs or, in the case of Japan, onsens. You know, they're looking for other experiences, right? So there's no question that the Chinese resorts are much more, I wouldn't even call them ski resorts. They are destination activity resorts that skiing is just one component. So it's kind of something I've been trying to get our developers is stop trying to push only skiing, because people want much more than that from the experience.
Home to over 4 billion people, the Asia-Pacific region boasts one of the most powerful consumer markets on the planet. Not only is it home to half of the world's under 30 population, but it's also home to more than half the world's internet users. It's a market that no globally minded organization should ignore. But entering markets like China, Japan, or Southeast Asia is no easy task. Just ask the likes of Microsoft, Google, Uber, and Facebook. However, times are changing, and with the right partners, doors are slowly opening as more and more companies find success growing their key markets in APAC. I myself spent 8 years in China, mostly as a venture capitalist, helping early-stage tech companies grow in the Asia-Pacific market successfully. This show is dedicated to uncovering and examining successful Asia market entry and growth strategies by interviewing the experts who've done it before and truly understand what it takes to be successful in the region. My name is Todd Embley, and welcome to the Negotiation, brought to you by WPIC Marketing and Technologies.
Justin, welcome back to the Negotiation Podcast.
Great to be here, Todd. Always good to be here.
Okay, so first off, where in the world does this podcast find you today?
Well, don't feel sad for me, but I am in snow heaven in Niseko, Hokkaido, Japan. I'm not going to lie. I'm glad you set this meeting for like mid-morning, because we had a good 50 centimeters of fresh snow overnight. So I had to get out and test the product. So yeah, all good on this end.
Oh, you did. You got out, eh? Oh, that's amazing. You told me before we hit record, how many meters of snow did you get? What, in January alone?
Well, December last year, we actually had the snowiest December in 67 years. This December, we had the lowest snowfall in 20 years, but January turned it on. We had just a click over 7 meters of snow in January, and it just keeps on coming. It was almost every single day we got a top up. Couldn't have been better.
Yeah. And then here in Western Canada, or probably even the Western United States, at least in the Northwest, it's been really dry. And really warm. I know back east, as usual, they get slammed, massive storms, but we are struggling a little bit out in our area of the world. So I'm jealous. Like I was telling you,
you've got time for it to bounce back. So don't give up on it yet.
We do. And last year was kind of similar. February kind of turns it on a little bit. And then hopefully coming into March, we get some nice spring skiing and we'll wrap it up and hopefully get those season's passes paid off. But let me ask, other than out enjoying the massive amount of pow-pow, what have you been spending most of your time on since we last spoke? Do you have any new projects, markets, priorities that have been taking up your focus lately?
Well, I think last time we spoke, I was probably still flip-flopping backwards and forwards between China and Japan, and that's been the same. I'm pretty much in China during the winter, 1 week of each month. I was there last week. I've got to go again next week. But for the majority of the winter, and it depends on the priorities, I am spending a lot of time in Japan. There's a lot going on here. It's the kind of the most aspirational ski market in the world at the moment. So there's a lot of focus and energy on keeping ahead of what the customers are wanting. missing and how to improve on what is a, you know, what's got a culturally rich and long history of Japanese skiing, but how to keep up with all these new markets coming in. So, you know, pretty much between China and Japan, we've got an ongoing project in Vietnam as well, a mountain resort that will have a skiing component to it as well. So that broke ground just before Christmas. So we're also flipping backwards and forwards to northern Vietnam. So kind of keeping it in the region, but still kind of feeding off clients and projects and interest from other parts of the world, both inbound and outbound out of Asia.
Yeah, it's just exploding over there, and that's awesome. You mentioned China. Zooming out, how would you characterize the 2025-2026 ski season in China?
We're still not even halfway through it yet, but it's been tracking well. I think Douyin or say TikTok's data for late 2025, so just leading up to the end of the year, said that ski resort searches were up 29% and transactions were up 49%. So anecdotally, it sounds like the industry has, or the ski season's been doing well so far. From the resorts that we're involved with, they're all experiencing growth. I think they're getting a better yield per guest in the resorts at the moment. So people are spending more on lessons, more on rentals, more on food and beverage, and they're looking for more premium experiences. So, I think this year in China's, let's just say, this season's kind of post-Olympic normal. And now it's kind of growing into structural strength would be my technical way of saying it. So it's definitely it's no longer really event driven. It's more habit driven. So I think this is now a routine for Chinese people. So you know, we're now looking at around 25, 30 million annual skier visits, which puts it in the, you know, in the top markets in the world. And it's showing no sign of slowing down. So, 10 years ago, people sitting on the chairlift, the conversation would be, okay, how do I get off this thing? And then once I'm on the snow, how do I stop? And now the questions are, okay, which resort overseas should I be going to? Because now I'm good at this. So definitely the trends and the patterns of people are changing, which is great.
Yeah, that's true too. Let's try to look at both China, Japan. And, you know, I'm interested, A, in how the 2025-26 has gone for Japan. But then between the two markets, what's similar? And where are the markets diverging?
Okay, if you say they're converging, I'd say they're converging in ambition and a desire to grow and for people to be involved in the sport, but they're diverging in maturity, let's say. So, you know, Japan's operating from a position of like great depth, you know, many decades of a ski culture, strong system, strong, instruction programs, and a lot of natural snowfall, whereas China is still building its base. But it's doing it extremely fast and at great scale. So those would be kind of the difference. You know, Japan's a fairly mature market that's attracting a lot of foreign interest, and China's growing extremely fast from an immature base, but mostly on the back of domestic business. So Japan, I think, this year is, you know, because of where it's at and the global interest in it, it's really focusing on, let's say, yield management, how to handle capacity, because the resorts are getting very, very busy, and also improving on the quality of experience, because before, Japanese resorts didn't spend a lot of time or energy kind of souping it up to make it kind of at the St. Moritz's or the Whistlers or the Aspens of the world. So that's kind of where Japan is at the moment. And China is still focused on kind of conversion and retention, like keeping people, like the word just going to come for one time for a try. Now they're turning them into, you know, lifelong participants. So, so I think one of the key overlaps between the Chinese skiers now is, one of the most important, say, drivers of demand is for family travel, instruction, and premium accommodation. So that's kind of what the Chinese skiers are now becoming an unbelievably important market for Japan as well. So that's kind of where I think they come together.
In the past podcast, we've talked a little bit about economics, and I'm always interested in how resorts handle passes, ski passes, seasons passes, 4-day passes, evening passes versus the daytime lift pit tickets and the pricing of which. Can you speak to a little bit about how they do things over there? Are they looking to secure? Because I think the fear and what they're always guarding against is that they would rather have a higher floor of revenue and known revenue on the season's pass side, because weather, as we know, is super unpredictable, and then kind of let the day passes go where the prices are extremely high. I think for me, where I am, our season's pass, I need to go less than 10 times to pay off my season's pass, which mm-hmm. seems incredible when you're getting up 30, 40 times typically in the season, at least, unless you're retired, then you're getting up about 80 to 100. But how do they handle it over there? Is it the same kind of mental concept around the economics?
I'd say I don't have the data on that one specifically, so it's just more from an observation. I think seasons pass products are not as popular in China or Japan as they are in North America. And I think the large reason that is people, from what I can see, are not particularly loyal to one location. They're not going to go to that one location all the time. Most of the skiers, say in China, are coming out of tier one cities. So they're in Beijing or they're in Shanghai or they're in Guangzhou, and then they're saying, okay, this month I'm going to go to Xinjiang, or next month I'm going to go to Jilin. So and once they're in those places, they're not necessarily sticking to one specific resort. So I think in China they're much more multi-day and single day passes. There's not as many sub products. You might have a half day ticket or even a 2 hour ticket, but it's not as complicated or as intricate as the pass products might be in North America. In Japan, I think it's also a little bit the same. Passes, people say up in here in Niseko, the local people aren't buying seasons passes, they're buying hourly passes. And the reason why they do that is this is the mecca for backcountry skiing. So once you click on and activate your 1 hour ticket, it basically gives you enough time to make it to the top of the mountain, exit the gates, and then your pass kind of clicks off. So the most useful pass for a local person is, say, a 30 hour or 50 hour pass, and that can last them a month or two, right? So they're not buying day tickets. The tourists are buying the day tickets, but they're not buying seasons passes. And what is becoming more and more popular, as you will know from North America, is the Icon Pass and the Epic Pass. So we're on the Icon Pass here, and we receive an unbelievable amount of North American visitors that are on the Icon Pass coming through this area. But again, they're also touring around different resorts as well at the same time.
That's really interesting. I've never heard of an hourly pass, but you know, that can, you know, make sense. You look at the economies of other, I mean, let's look at it from this point of view, where what is the resort mostly offering you when you want to activate in the sport and do the activity? It's transportation. It's transportation mm-hmm. to the top of the mountain, where if you buy a bus pass, you know, typically it's for a ride. But then if you want maybe a subway pass, you can get it for a certain amount of time. You can ride as much as you want. There is a lot of different ways that you can actually look at doing it. I mean, I think a lot of people might, if you were to measure certain people, they get to the top. You know, they're skiers, they're not even having to strap back into their snowboard, they're coming off, they're carving around, and they're gone, and they're back down at the chairlift in 15 minutes. Whereas some mm-hmm. people, you know, if I'm with young children, we could be on, you know, 45 minutes before we get back down to the, you know, chairlift, and that person's already done three runs. So
yep.
they're taking more advantage of what they're actually paying for than somebody who is a little bit slower down the hill, takes longer runs, or spending more time out in the backcountry. So,
yeah, well, the reality is that your value for money should be your ski experience. And a lot of people have it in their mind is I only rode the lift three times, so I didn't get value for the money. Like, it's not a transportation. It is a transportation system, but that's not really what you're paying for. So it is a psychological thing for sure.
Yeah, because I mean, it's all the grooming and all the, you know, the marking and, you know, all this activity in the summer, removing the deadwood, you know, the whole night stump control, all that kind of stuff. Okay, great. Let's talk a little bit about participation. This is always contentious in a way, you know, the skier versus snowboarder. So what does that participation breakdown look like in China today?
Well, it depends. Some resorts are more skewed toward skiers and some are more skewed toward snowboarders. But if you look at the Chongli region, which is north of Beijing, was the kind of the key hubs for the 2022 games. There's seven resorts up there, and two of them at least, they see more than 80% snowboarders. So there's definitely like a congregation of, yeah, it's quite amazing. They're spending big money on parks and kind of the snowboard experience and brands and culture around snowboarding. Just the demographic is quite interesting. And others are staying very much pure to skiers. But I would, if I was to put a number on it, I would say it's probably slightly 50% more advantage to snowboarders than skiers, but it's fairly close. Whereas in Japan, I think, depending on where you go, here I would say there's a higher proportion of skiers than snowboarders.
Okay, fantastic. How would you profile the skier or snowboarder? And I'm talking age, income, family status, motivations, and how is that changing over the years?
For China, I assume you're talking.
Sure, let's see China.
I'd say they're, it's shifted dramatically over the past 10, 15 years. There's no question. I think probably globally it has. But I'd say you're looking at an urban type of participant. They're middle to upper income. They're most often they're family based with a young kid or kids, depending on what part of the country. They're all heavily focused on education, on health, and on international exposure. So it's not an adrenaline sport for Chinese. It's more of a social interaction, get some international skill, focus on your health, focus on being with your family. I think that's actually why the government really likes skiing, because it actually is doing something to keep the mental thinking and the health of the country kind of focused on good things rather than, economy or stuff like this. So I think Gen Z is growing particularly fast in China, especially for freestyle and snowboarding. But I think the real economic driver is still families continuing on or committing to multi-year learning paths, right? That's where it's at. Like they're all about setting a standard, and this is where I got to be. So I think I was talking to a Chinese family actually here in Japan a couple of days ago, and the mother said about their kid, it said, skiing is just like piano lessons. So we don't ask the kid if the kid likes it yet, right? You just got to keep on going until you're good at it, and then I'll ask you if you like it. So that mindset's really powerful for the long-term participation of the sport, as the parents are really driving their kids to get into it. Then magically, they just fall in love with it, and there you've got your industry.
How are the resorts and how is the sport, the industry, marketing, selling, attracting new customers and clients to the sport? What are they using? How are they doing it over there?
Again, in China, it's being hammered into the through government programs, particularly in the education system in China. So, every school-aged child is being exposed to all of the winter sports, whether it's ice skating or curling or skiing, snowboarding. So the school curriculum is actually bringing it in, and it's the kids programs that are getting that's the one that's igniting the flame or triggering the interest. And then, of course, they get the bug and the parents need to start ponying up and taking them on the out of school trips. So I think the large push is really through the government, to be honest. You turn on a TV screen in China any day, it's not even about the fact that the Olympics are on, but China's performing well in the World Cups and things like this, specifically in snowboarding and freestyle. And so the media is all over that. So anytime you turn on a sports channel or the news, there's some clip or something going on about winter sport. Anytime you get on a plane, the screens on the TV are promoting go to northern China, experience snow culture. It's not even about skiing, but experience snow culture, experience the different parts of China. So it's really, not to give all the credit to the government, but the government has really been the driver behind it.
Well, that's not unusual, though. I mean, the government has such powerful octane ability when it wants to get behind something, and they're able to do that. And this is just one of the best things for them to get behind, and all the benefits, the mental, the physical health, you know, everything. I mean, it is wonderful. And then money flows and participation grows, and it's great. I mean, it's wonderful. Now, you mentioned, you know, the 2026 Olympics and watching people on TV and some of their who are those homegrown? Who are the Chinese skiers and snowboarders that we should be watching as potential contenders for medals? And how realistic are those medal expectations for them?
Well, sure. I mean, China's strongest medal potential, like I've said a couple of times, is really in freestyle skiing and snowboarding. So freestyle skiing, mostly aerials, and snowboard is mostly big air and half pipe. So China's invested a lot of money into these disciplines, and they've already proven that they've got success on the World Cups and even at the previous Olympic Games. So alpine skiing is still a long-term project. So the pipeline of talent, I think, is there, but alpine success really requires multi-generational thing, thousands of hours of vertical skiing every year, and it being exposed from being children, basically. So China's got a few more generations before it becomes an alpine nation. But I think, you know, we need to be realistic about China's success possibilities. They'll be competitive for sure. There'll be Chinese athletes in the finals, and there will be selective medal chances, but they're not going to dominate, I think, like perhaps they did in Beijing. So, yeah, you got your big names, you know, freestyle skiing. You've got obviously got Eileen Gu, our adopted legend. So she'll do pretty well in free ski, half pipe and big air, as she's always doing. You've got Sui Ming on the snowboard side, who is just killing it out there at the moment. He's in top form. So he'll be defending his big air in big air and slopestyle medals from Beijing. And he's kind of considered to be the top prospect for next week. You've got people like Xu Mengtou, who did very well in the last Olympics in aerials. You got Qi Guangpu, who is also she's a veteran, but is also kind of a leader in the aerial squad. I think those are, you know, you got young ones like Liu Mengqing, who's a rising free ski talent, had several podiums in big air and slope style this year. So I think we'll see these names really kind of rise to the top next week.
Okay. Awesome. Yes, we will be watching those as well. Do you expect the Milan Olympics to materially boost skiing participation in China, across Asia, even similar to what we saw around Beijing 2022, or will the impact look different this time? I think I know the answer, but I'll ask that question.
All right. Well, I'm not sure if my answer will surprise you then. I think the impact will be different than it was in 2022 for sure. It'll still be meaningful. Like, I think 22 was more about permission, like proving that winter sports belonged in China. So it was kind of China's coming out in the winter sport thing. 26 in Milan will be about aspiration. So I think it's really to the Chinese skiing population, it's going to reinforce skiing as like a global lifestyle driven activity. So I think we're as a result of 2026 or the upcoming games, we're going to see much greater increase in outbound ski travel, like more Chinese people now. They've honed their skills in China. They can see how beautiful the rest of the world is and how they can have different cultural experience. They'll want to go overseas. I think we'll see much bigger growth in people wanting premium equipment. They'll want to own their own equipment rather than renting it. Like, this is all the next step. And that's why China's ski economy is unbelievably important to the global ski economy, because these are now not just one-time users. They're into it. They're investing. They're buying the quality clothes or buying the ski equipment. And I think, again, not to harp on this one, we'll just see continued growth in training for, you know, ski instructor and youth racing programs and things like this. So I think to sum it, I think while Beijing kind of made people curious about the sport, Milan will make them picky. Like, they will now, they want better. So that's really the sign that the market's matured. That's my take on it.
Okay, excellent. Thank you very much. Now, one area we've spoken about before is the indoor skiing. the snow domes. And that's so fascinating still. How is that segment continuing to evolve in China today? Is it still a gateway to the outdoor skiing, or is it becoming its own standalone category?
Well, I think it's both a gateway and a standalone. I think it's evolved into both. It remains the primary gateway for first timers, for sure. And also for school groups. I mean, you've got, I don't even know, let's say tens of millions of school kids in urban areas in southern China that are being encouraged to experience winter sports. So school programs going into these domes is a huge business. So not only that, it's also becoming, I think, a training base for racers and for freestyle athletes, because they can train year round. And these things, you know, by global standards, are enormous facilities. Like, they're not just one little run, one boring little intermediate run. I mean, some of the domes we've been involved with have black diamond trails and moguls courses and big air jumps and slope style course, all of this type of thing.
All the things I avoid.
Yeah. Yes. We all should it. Well, I'll speak for my age. Yes.
I don't heal like I used to.
Well, just don't fall. That's the easiest part.
Oh, right.
But I think it's also these venues have become like a fitness and lifestyle venues for first tier cities, right? So it's really become a melting pot and a collection space for like-minded people. So look, China has the largest indoor ski market in the world by far, and that infrastructure, like, there's still dozens of these things in planning and underway that we haven't even seen come into play yet. So I know people in Shanghai that go skiing indoors twice a week. They fly north to northern China once a year. They fly to Japan once a year. And this hybrid model of play a couple of times and hone your skills in the indoor and then migrate to north and overseas is how it works for China.
Yeah. I mean, you like golf, you go and hit the driving range. Do a little chipping and putting and something, and then you travel down to Scottsdale, Arizona, and play a bunch of the really expensive courses and lose 1,000 balls.
There you go.
Now, speaking to brands or for brands a little bit, want to talk about the commercial perspective and where you might be seeing the biggest opportunities right now, and things like, you know, the resorts, like the hotels, right? Accommodation, equipment, apparel, training, or just the other experiences.
Yeah, look, the biggest opportunities sit around skiing, not just on the slopes, right? So the resorts are obviously doing very well, and they deserve to, because they had invested a lot of capital up front, and then they got saddled with the COVID doldrums for a couple of years, and now they're digging themselves out, and they're going to start hopefully being able to reinvest. So there'll be upgrades in equipment on mountain, and people still buying the resorts still buying new grooming machines and investing in snowmaking and upgrading lifts. So that'll always be there. But as you just touched on, and as I've mentioned a little bit earlier, is I think the things that are really going to continue to show opportunity are instruction and training programs, no question. Youth programs and camps. So not, you know, people can, you know, we would do it in North America for sure, but now China is starting to develop these educational and multi-day or multi-week go to the mountains and, you know, educate their school curriculum is part of the day, and then their athlete education is another part of the day. So these types of camps are starting to grow, and there'll be definitely interest from international content for that. Experiential travel, for sure. Places where you can ski and learn and eat and learn about a new culture are both in China and outside of China. They're going to be huge. And things like premium services, because now this is the market now that they understand how it works and they're willing to invest in it. And the Chinese traveler loves experiences and loves to, you know, pay high quality things they'll pay money for high quality things. Things like lockers or dining or concierge services or guiding, all of these things are going to grow. So the hardware, of course, matters, I think, and that's what people tangibly look at as where the investment is going. But the software, like the people, the programs, experience design, that's where the real money is in the future. So yeah, that's what I think.
Let me ask you a little bit about those experiences, because from where I am, Western Canada, when you go to the resort, there are a lot of things to do. And I'm wondering if they have those similarly in Asia. So we have Tube Town, So you get all the tubing down. You can do ice climbing. So they'll build these towers and just, you know, get out the fire hose and just cover them in ice over, you know, certain days and weeks. And then you get the ice picks and the special shoes and the whole thing. And you can get all geared up and you get harnessed in. So it's like rock climbing, but the outdoor version. And there's the ponds where they have, you know, ice skating, and they'll even have pond hockey games going on, mini snowmobiles, horse-drawn hay rides with the sleighs that are going around. You have the fat tire bikes, you know, that's just everything. Any way, snowshoeing, you name it, right? They have everything all available. So there's so many other things going on outside of the alpine and the cross country. Are those represented? Are those kind of activities there at these resorts as well?
In China, absolutely. In fact, the Chinese skier is quite different. Well, maybe similar to what you're just describing, but they're not going to ski all day, every day. They're not going to be on the lift at 8:30 and still skiing at 4. You know, they'll ski for a couple of hours. They'll want to go to hot springs, or in the case of Japan, onsens. You know, they're looking for other experiences, right? So there's no question that the Chinese resorts are much more, I wouldn't even call them ski resorts. They are destination activity resorts that skiing is just one component. So that's kind of something I've been trying to get our developers is stop trying to push only skiing, because people want much more than that from the experience. Certainly, and the season is not long either. I guess similar to most places in the world, but it's not long. So it's really about how to keep the revenue clock spinning 365 days a year, 24 hours a day. And so there's much more investment going into the non-white season, let's call it. And that's where the growth and the opportunity for investment into the winter is going to come, because people are visiting these resorts in the summertime. So what I've, and so if you keep in mind that most of the, and well, obviously keep in mind that the Chinese traveler is, they're traveling in multi-generations, right? So they're traveling with the little kids, they're traveling with the siblings, they're traveling with the parents and the grandparents. So there's got to be something for all of these different generations to be doing. So it's not just about skiing. In Japan, what I've noticed is, especially now, because let's just call it the Southeast Asian market, is they're all of a sudden getting more expendable income. They're more travel aware. They're more mobile. So really where I see, obviously, we've got the big mountain skiers coming from, you know, Northern Europe and North America at the moment to Japan. But the real growth market is going to be Southeast Asia. So Vietnam, Malaysia, Indonesia, Thailand, and these people want snow play. So, you know, all of a sudden we're looking outside, you got the guys out there with their, you know, 115, 120 wide underfoot powder skis. And you got people out there with like little snow shovels trying to build a snowman because they just want to experience snow. So it's this phenomenon in Japan is becoming more interesting. So I think we'll see a lot more, say, snow play related activities and soft adventure coming out of Japan. And China will just continue to be kind of all over the place with this, you know, it'll just continue to come up with new and crazy ideas to keep people entertained.
Is there a, call them a snowmobile, as we call them, sleds, or snow bike culture out there? Because where I live, I you know, it's quite small. Everybody, they oscillate between seasons because they're out on their ATVs and side by sides in the summer, huge now, or their motorbikes, right? Their BMX, you know, their outdoor or backcountry kind of dirt bikes. And then now they just simply transition. They got the big platforms on the back of their 4x4s. They load up the sleds or the snow bikes. You know, the difference being there's the two skis on the front versus the one ski on the front. And you know, it's huge. It's huge. And they race, all over the place. And that's a really, really big activity thing out here. Is that a culture? Is that a thing out there?
It's not yet. I think certainly not in China, because if you look at most of the resorts in, certainly in Northeast China, you don't have unlimited snow like you would say in Canada or in Japan. So the snow is mostly man-made. So you're kind of restricted to the areas where the snow is being made. perhaps in Northwest China and Xinjiang, this will become more of a thing. But it's mostly driven by tours, right? So it's a programmed type of product. It's not people going out there buying a snowmobile and just doing whatever they want. So no one's doing that in China yet. Not to say that it won't happen. Japan, also the same. So you don't see everyone out there with their F-350s with their $100,000 worth of sleds on the back. But you do see a lot of people doing guided tours, soft adventure along a trail, very, very popular for because these things are unique pieces of equipment, right? So but you don't see people just out there unguided, unscripted. It's much more of an orchestrated program. In Japan, there's a lot of powder, a lot of snow, but there's also a lot of, say, inherent danger out there. So the government doesn't necessarily allow people just to freewheel it. It's all got to be a guided experience for the most part. But that, you know, it's definitely of interest.
I ask that because I have heard that snowmobiling and snowmobile racing, whatever, it's back in the Olympics this year, if I'm not mistaken.
So, oh, really? I didn't hear that. Okay.
I don't participate, but I've heard from those who do that they said they, you know, I was talking to someone and they're, oh, I'm watching my friend. He's at the Red Bull, something's on whatever. And yeah, it's really exciting because it's back in the Olympics this year. Cannot confirm past that hearsay, but I have heard some form of it is now back in the Olympics for this year. So I don't know. Hit me up if I'm wrong.
I'll Google that one and I'll let you know.
That's right. podcast@wpic.co. my name is Liam and you want to send me an email if I'm wrong. If I'm right, my name is Todd Embley. Now, last question. If you had to summarize the next 5 years for skiing in China or Japan in a few sentences, what should brands, investors, and operators be paying closest attention to?
Look, as I'll just repeat more or less what I've said before. I think China's transitioning now from like a participation growth, like the growth of the market is still growing incrementally each year, but now it's to participant quality, right? So they're looking for more quality experiences and are willing to spend on it. And I think Japan is transitioning from volume growth to, let's just say, optimizing value, you know. So I think, you know, given most of the customers are coming in from overseas, they're coming with different expectations and are paying different prices for the similar products in other countries. So Japan's now really trying to figure out how to cater to, you know, not price itself out of the market like other countries, like perhaps the US has done. It's become kind of increasingly unaffordable to ski in North America for a lot of people. So Japan's got to try to make sure that they don't go down that path as well. So I think brands and investors kind of really need to look at, say, the ecosystem, cross-border ecosystems, how all of these different things work. Really got to think about long-term customer lifestyle value, I think, is very important. And as I've said several times, it's about youth development and education-driven participation. I think that's key for the Asian market. So if I was to kind of wrap a bow around it, I'd probably say over the past 5 years or so, teaching, it was all about teaching China how to ski. And the next 5 years will be more about watching how Chinese skiers shape the global industry. So it's inevitable. And I think, you know, like the Japanese market was unbelievably important to the North American market back in the 90s, China for the next 10 years is going to be what Japan was in the early 90s. And I think people just have to get ready for it. They're coming, they're good spenders, they're good travelers, they're good consumers. So I think just be ready for them.
Yeah. Okay. That's amazing. Well, Justin, I hope that there's some afternoon skiing perhaps in your future today.
I haven't taken my ski attire off yet. So no, there may be a chance for that.
I was going to say, I mean, you kind of came in and you still had the balaclava circle. No, you didn't. yeah, it came shooting in off the course. It's a ski in, ski out podcast recording today, people. Justin Downs, president of Access Leisure Management. Thank you very much for your time, buddy. We always appreciate having you on the show.
Thanks, Todd. Appreciate it.
And we always appreciate everybody who listens. If you appreciate us, please feel free to leave us a like or a thanks or a review or even hit that subscribe button, which the algorithms always love. That way more people will find this podcast when looking for this kind of content. But from me, from Justin, and from everybody at the negotiation team, thank you very much for listening and or watching, and we will see you next time.
Growing a company is hard. Doing it in a foreign market, exponentially so. The best piece of advice I can give you is not to do it alone. When you start looking at the Asia-Pacific region for further expansion possibilities, and I sincerely hope you do, make sure you choose the right partners to do it with. My good friends at WPIC Marketing and Technologies have almost 20 years of experience helping brands, just like yours, enter China, Japan, and Southeast Asia. I hope you enjoyed this episode of The Negotiation, and if you're interested in being a guest or want to connect with me or any of our team, please reach out to us at podcast@wpic.co, and be sure to rate, comment, and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.